Welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Stringini. We're on the book of Genesis, chapter 26. Verse 1. And there was a famine in the land, beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham, back in chapter 12. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. Verse 2. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, Do not go down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father. And I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Because that Abraham obeyed my voice, and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes and my laws. So we have this famine in the days of Isaac, paralleling the famine in the days of Abraham. And in the time of stress, he has to go to another place. And he goes to Abimelech, which is an official title. It means like father king. Abi means father, Melech means king. So that's the official title. It's not a personal name. It's not the same guy as in chapter 20. There was another Abimelech. And so the Lord appears to him and reiterates the promise that he had given Abraham to bless him and his seed and to give unto him and his seed all those countries and to perform the oath which he had sworn and to multiply the seed as the stars of heaven. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. It's really interesting that as far back as Genesis, you know, from the time of Abraham, there was this idea that Israel would be a blessing to all the nations of the world. And it was to be through their carrying out God's will, by obeying his voice, keeping his charge, his commandments, his statutes, his laws. You know, God gives us charges. You know, it's like you're charged with some duty, which must be observed and performed. And there are commandments which are to be obeyed, statutes and laws. It's really no different in Christ, because there is a law of Christ to obey. There's a faith to obey. There are teachings to acknowledge. And so the ultimate form of this promise is Christ. He is the one, the seed, the promised seed. You know, how else could we construe that to be true? I guess I think of, what's the Jews' perspective? Because they have to have a perspective. But these are their oldest stories. I mean, they go back to the time of their first fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the idea is at the very beginning, the prophets make mention of Isaac. They make mention of Jacob and Abraham. They know who they were. And they knew what their calling was. But how did they become a blessing to all nations? You know, it was always something that was needed to be fulfilled. But most of the time, they were a curse to themselves. I mean, read the prophets. Jeremiah, for most of Israel's history, is a story of how they went astray. And they did not fulfill what God had charged them with. Except perhaps through a remnant. There was always a remnant that God was graciously regarding through their, you know, belief in him. They believed God. Because none of them had ever walked perfectly according to the statutes and laws. But they had kept the charge. They had obeyed his voice. And to whatever degree his grace would allow, they performed these things. But in Christ, the idea is that we had a man come who performed all those things and laid his life down. And through faith in him, we all might be partakers of Abraham's covenant and might become the seed of Abraham. Because we are the children of God through faith, as Abraham was a child of God through faith. Because he believed God, and that's why it was imputed to him for righteousness. And yes, he did obey God also. I mean, we don't want to say, oh, well, God, you say do this, I won't do it. You know, they were not defiant. I think there's a big difference you got to draw between things we do due to our nature, faults, sinful things that we need God's help to overcome versus things that we just stubbornly refuse. I mean, because some people, they reject the faith. Some people, they reject the very commandments of God. Like if God comes and says, well, you can't do that, and you say, well, I'm doing it anyways. That's the heathen, you know, the unbelievers. Verse 6, and Isaac dwelt in Gerar. And the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, she is my sister. For he feared to say, she is my wife, lest, said he, the men of this place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. Abraham had the same thing. He was very concerned that he would get killed for the sake of his wife. That's not an unreal proposition when you're a stranger in a strange land. If you're a stranger in a country among strangers, and they're hostile to outsiders. You know, we think of our modern, like if you think about America and how we treat people who come from other countries, and you think, at least, I mean, legally, like their legal status, that they have rights and so forth. We treat them that way. And that is based on God's law. Well, it's based on a lot more than that, but in the law of God, to treat the stranger you weren't to treat him with a different set of laws. You weren't to have like a set of laws where it was acceptable to murder a stranger in your land, but of course you couldn't murder a citizen. Well, in some countries, you know, I guess I'm thinking of something I recently saw about South Africa, where it's, you know, the farmers there, they're white, and a lot of them are being murdered because they're a stranger in a strange country that is kind of lawless or descending into lawlessness. And there's a lot of bitterness that's been generated there. And you see it in the way the when the Europeans immigrated to North America, and there's a lot of hostility between the natives and the Europeans, and they killed each other. And, you know, people would say, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Look, I understand the natives saw themselves being displaced, so they fought. And the Europeans, they were here, you know, and they wanted to live here. And so they fought to defend what they built in this new land, which was new to them. And it's the story of history. And it's not about, and my point is not so much right or wrong, but Isaac was justified in his fear, at least to some degree. And because the thing is, you know, if you go to somebody and say, oh, well, you know, I'm afraid you people are going to kill me. What are they going to say? Yeah, we're going to kill you. I mean, that's when they get to that point, that's dangerous. That's when it's time to leave immediately. Yeah, we are going to kill you. What is it to you? You're in our land. You don't belong here. This is the place where, you know, you're not native to this place. And, you know, like some of these third world countries where, you know, people with skills have gone and immigrated, like to South Africa. They've gone there to do farming and the country was once prospering. But of course, because they had like apartheid where the blacks were kept separate and it was very hard on them, right? Relatively speaking. But now it's even worse because out of bitterness, there's been a lot of retaliation. Meaning the oppression that used to exist is better, or the situation of everyone under that oppressive system was actually better than the way it's turning out now, which is horrible for everybody. Because if you're going to be oppressed, you might as well be oppressed by people who are, are successful at making money and so on and so forth. I mean, what am I getting at? Well, because what's going to fall out in the story here with Isaac is he does very well in their land. And they start to not like it. And people are like this. But if you say to them, hey, I'm afraid you're going to kill me for my wife. Just say it like that. They're not going to say, oh, that's what we were going to do. They're going to say, well, why? We're not barbarians. And the thing is, it's been seen in a lot of injustices in many countries, even in America, where you had the reverse situation where, after slavery was abolished in the South, they had the Jim Crow and the blacks down there. The different standard of law applied to them because they were the out group. They weren't really part of the society. They were these ex-slaves. They were ex-property. So they were treated terribly, and the law did not protect them the same. You could just go out and lynch them at least to some degree. I mean, or they did. Men would go out and lynch them and then get away with it. I don't know that, you know, they put masks on and stuff, and they were, you know, but it wasn't investigated, and I'm sure a lot of people knew who had been responsible. But some people didn't get a trial. Some people just got hung. Some people just got killed. And so Isaac is in a similar situation of a country where he's not from there. And he knows it. And he knows he has something precious with him, his wife. And that she's fair to look upon. And he's a little bit concerned that they will kill him. Because that's the world he lived in. Verse 8, and it came to pass that when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. Yeah, I never looked up that word sporting with. My note says it could be said caressing. But sporting, you know, it's play. They're playing in the manner that men and women have done for all time. You know, he didn't observe an actual something, but something that made it obvious that, like, there was more. This wasn't his sister. No, she's not. That's not his sister. Pretty sure about that. Verse 9, and Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety, she is thy wife. And how saidst thou, she is my sister? And Isaac said unto him, because I said, lest I die for her. I don't want to die for her. So, I mean, on the sense of die for the sake of her being attractive to somebody else. Verse 10, and Abimelech said, what is this thou hast done unto us? One of the people might lightly have lying with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us. And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he that toucheth this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. The king has a sense of what is right. Because that's the thing, is that if the person in power will make a decree protecting the oppressed minority, so to speak, or just the minorities. I don't like the oppression narrative, really. But they're a minority, and they could be oppressed, right? And so the king makes a preemptive thing saying, anybody touches this man or his wife is going to die. He puts a death penalty on it. So to protect him. You know, and he says, I don't think facetiously, but somewhat, you know, here's the thing. He says, one of the people might have lightly lain with thy wife, you know, thinking it's just your sister. He might have just lain with her. And that's kind of, she's willing. And thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us through your deceit, is his meaning. But if that's so, you know, why doesn't he just go and say, well, just announce that that's his wife? If your people are so righteous, why do you have to put a death penalty on it? Is it to assure Isaac? Or is it because there's some truth in what Isaac feared? But the king, I think, in his concern is actually genuine. Is he does not want the guiltiness of such a thing to come upon him or his people. There's always a sense, I think, in many rulers that if they do wrong, that the gods, you know, in his view of whatever his gods are going to be angry. Because the wrong behavior often does bring about consequences. And you never know how far that's going to go. And he did not want that guilt to be brought upon him or his people. And so he charged them with this commandment to leave Isaac and his wife alone. Verse 12. Then Isaac sowed in that land and received the same year 100-fold. And the Lord blessed him. So he was very blessed in his sowing, you know, in his efforts to prosper, 100-fold. Whatever he put out, it was multiplied 100 times. So he had a plentiful harvest. And the man waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great. For he had possession of flocks and possession of herds and great store of servants. And the Philistines envied him. Remember, Abraham had a similar thing of a very extended influence. You understand that Abraham and Isaac were almost petty kings in their own right. Abraham went to war. you know, with his servants. The number of them is never quite given, but he already had like a people about him. So the Philistines were envious of him. Here again, the man from another country comes in, you know, a different person, and he is prospering in someone else's land. You know, why is he doing so well? I'm not an apologist for the rich, and I have no, I'm not rich, okay, except in the things of God. You know, I'm not saying this because of something like I got personally going. I got nothing personally going that makes me need to defend this, because no one has ever envied me my prosperity. I've been envied for my happiness. I've been envied for my spiritual blessings. I've been envied for my family and for the kind of children and the relationship I have with my wife. I've been envied for those things, but never for my wealth. I don't have the kind of wealth or possessions that brings about envy. You know, some people might look at my small home and my happy situation and feel a sort of like, I wish I could have something so simple and be happy with it. But a lot of people just aren't happy with simple things. Okay. And that's what it gets to, is like, I'll tell you what, I got some very rich neighbors. And the thing is, people look at the wealthy often, men who have gotten them wealth. And the modern narrative is that they did something wrong. Like, that to get rich, you have to take your wealth from somebody else. That you have to be oppressing somebody else to get to the point where you have a lot of money. And now that's just simply not true. You can get to wealth through oppression. But a lot of times, the road to wealth is simply hard work in pursuit of wealth. Most of the people I know who have money just work really hard. And they don't spend money on silly things. And they have money because it's been a high priority in their life to get more money. And so they're wealthy. They worked on earning money. They work hard every day on earning money. And therefore they have money. And to me, wealthy, you know, and they would say to me, I'm not rich, but to me they are rich. They're making a lot more than I make, and they have a lot more than I have. But I'm not envious of them because I know what they do. I know that they pursue what they want out of life with the same zeal I pursue what I want out of life. And they know what they want. They're very definite about what they want. They want to earn more money. And so they go and they work hard and they do it. That doesn't mean you can't be a man of God and be blessed in earning money also. Every man has his work to do in this world. You know, we got to work with our own hands. And by that I mean, we have to work, when I say with our own hands, it might be some non-labor type of job, but what it means is you have to do your own work to earn your own way. We all have to. And so, in the modern world, we often, you know, they, not we, but there are people in this world who will try to say, if somebody's wealthy, they did something wrong to get there. And the fact that other people aren't wealthy means that these people are somehow oppressing them. And that's kind of what happens with Isaac. He sows and he's prosperous. All right? And the Philistines look at him and they're jealous. They're envious of him, of his success. It's no different than Cain and Abel, really. You know, Abel brought his offering to God and it was accepted. Cain, not so. Doesn't give a lot of details of what was wrong. You know, we talked about it a bit, but really, we don't know. We just know that somehow whatever he was trying to do didn't work out. And a lot of times we'll try to do things in life. And I've had a lot of failures in life. I've tried a lot of things. I've had businesses fail. I've only been successful at a very few things. And those things happen to not be things that earned money. Successful in marriage and in family life, and things that a lot of people actually, you know, wish they had success in. So I'm not going to envy them their financial success, because I wouldn't trade that for what I've got. I'd like to have it in addition to what I've got. Surely I'd like to be more successful. And who wouldn't like to have all the things they do prosper? Isn't that why the prosperity gospel is so popular? The idea that, like, prosperity is part of the gospel, your financial prosperity. And I really don't think it is, though you can prosper in everything you do, just like Isaac did. But don't think that Isaac just didn't work at all. I mean, he isn't like, what does he do for a living? Well, he tends flocks and he plants things. He's a farmer and a herdsman. And he also has a lot of servants and stuff who work for him. So he's a big operation. And he runs it well. He's running it day and night from his tent. You know? So he's a big operator. He's like a petty king. You know, a little king in his own right. And he's very successful. And people would say, well, you know, look, he inherited a lot of that wealth from his father. Yeah, but you know what? Inherited wealth isn't necessarily something you get to keep. Some people inherit wealth and they spend it all on luxuries and on other things that are just, you know, they consume it all. They just consume the wealth. And that's that. Wealth is a weird thing. I mean, for some people, it's just a question of piling it up. They're like little squirrels just squirreling away the nuts, piling them up, work, piling up the nuts. And it's, you know, and people who don't work hard look at that and they envy it and they think like, well, you know, why don't I have a big pile of nuts? It's like, well, you're not squirreling them away. You're not expending every ounce of energy you have towards gathering nuts. If you did, if you put all your energy into that, it still wouldn't even be guaranteed that you would get that return. And that's what causes envy. People who are trying to do the same thing and not being successful at it. And today we have people who don't do anything and they're envious of the success. And they somehow think that they do nothing and that other people do everything. And somehow the people who do everything are responsible for them not doing anything and not having anything, having done nothing. But the thing is, the people who do everything, we should take everything from them and give it to the people who do nothing, which would be a recipe for disaster economically in any country. Just take away what people have worked for. I mean, there's a certain amount of taxation, of course. Like I said, I don't want to get too deep into politics. I'm getting into the concept of envy here. Beware of people who peddle envy. Be very wary of them. The peddlers of envy are evil. And they're peddling an evil ideology. It leads to things that are very dark and evil in the world. Some of the most murderous and repressive regimes in history were all based on envy of different classes of people. Or hatred of outsiders. You know, those two things, class envy and hatred of the other. So, that is not to say that it's not useful to have borders and stuff. When I talk about the other, I mean, you shouldn't hate the other, but you can't let them overrun you either. I mean, Isaac has his boundaries, as we're going to see. So, verse 15, for all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth. And Abimelech said unto Isaac, go from us, for thou art much mightier than we. So, Abraham had digged a lot of wells in the same area where now the Philistines are. And the Philistines had stopped them. Isn't that like I mean, think about it. That is such a typical human behavior. Instead of, you know, allowing the prosperity to continue, where they're just so offended by his prospering that they want to just put an end to it. Stop the wells. Make him go away. His prosperity is a threat. Go away. Get out of our country. You're taking away from us somehow by working so hard and planting and breeding your flocks. It's envy. And Abimelech said unto Isaac, okay, we read that. He knew your prosperity is causing problems and you need to go away. Verse 17, and Isaac departed thence and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water, which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham. And he called their names after the names by which his father had called them. And so I'm thinking that with Abraham's death and the change over to Isaac, and you know, he had given gifts to other descendants and whatever, there's a bit of a time where the Philistines have moved in And in order to keep, you know, a buffer between them and Isaac, they stopped up these wells to prevent it from being a useful area. And Isaac is busily digging them out again. Verse 19. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley and found there a well of springing water. Now, literally living in Hebrew. Living water. It probably means fresh and good. Not bitter in any way, but really vibrant, clean water. And he called the name of the well Verse 20. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water is ours." And he called the name of the well Esek, because they strove with him. And you can bet Esek means to strive or contend. And they digged another well, in verse 21, and strove for that also. And he called the name of it Sitna, which means opposition. He's now digging, and wherever he digs and finds water, they're saying, "Well, that's ours. That belongs to us." See, he's working to obtain things and building things where there is waste. You know, and that's what gets to envy. Like, people come and they look at the wealth of, like, America, and they say it was all stolen from other places. Not true. Wealth is not just like sitting around. It's like you look at like a piece of farmland. You have no idea how much work goes into that piece of land. They think, well, it grows crops. Yeah, but it's got to be worked. And if you want to get a real good return on it, it's got to be worked efficiently, with planning, with forethought. You know, people come into some place, they clear away the trees, they plant the crops, and it starts producing, and the wealth grows, and people say, they stole it. No, they developed it from something that was waste, that was nothing. It was maybe a wilderness. And they come in and they do that, and then people go, why do these strangers, why are they here being so successful in our land? And it's like, well, you know, people who occupied the land beforehand, you know, unless it was taken by violence, may have just been, you know, wandering around hunting and not doing anything. That's not to say that they don't deserve to be left in peace, but it is also wrong to say that someone who develops that piece of land is stealing. Or if there's a resource in a country, a lot of times countries have resources. And then more developed countries come in and they develop those resources and extract them. Say, oh, they stole all our minerals. No, it takes a big investment to extract those minerals. If they didn't come in and develop it, they'd still be sitting there. At some point, someone's going to develop and, you know, someone's going to plant the crops and reap the harvest. And when they reap the harvest, people who do nothing stand around and look at them and say, "You're stealing our harvest." It's wrong. It's just envy. And here he's digging wells. They're like, "That's our water. It's in our ground. You dug it out of our ground. That's our water." And he's like, okay. And he moves along to the next one. Digs another well. Verse 22. And he removed from thence and digged another well. And for that they strove not. And he called the name of it Rehoboth, which means roominess. Finally found space. And he said, "For now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." He needs a place where there's enough room for him, and the Philistines aren't going to be like, "You're taking our stuff." And he went up from thence to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared unto him the same night, and said, "I am the God of Abraham thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee, and will bless thee, and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake." And he builded an altar there, and called upon the name of the Lord, and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants digged a well. So the Lord has appeared to Isaac again, and said, "Don't be afraid, I am with you, to bless you and multiply your seed for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there, and called upon the name of the Lord, and pitched the tent there, and they digged another well. Verse 26, then Abimelech went to him from Gerar, and Ahazath, one of his friends, and Pichol, the chief captain of his army. And Isaac said unto them, Wherefore come ye to me, seeing ye hate me, and have sent me away from you? And they said, We saw certainly that the Lord was with thee. And we said, Let there be now an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee, that thou wilt do us no hurt, as we have not touched thee, and as we have not done unto thee nothing but good. And as we have done unto thee nothing but good, and have sent thee away in peace, thou art now the blessed of the Lord. So, you know, their way of looking at it is the people were envious, but the king has sent him away, not out of his own personal hatred, but because of the envy of his people. And certainly what he's saying is true. The claim here is true. Is we haven't harmed you. You know, the Philistines disputed over the well. They've been kind of, they've been envious. They've been kind of jerks, I guess you could say. Or, you know, what do you want to say? They've been, they've contended with him. They've been contentious and sort of coveted after his prosperity and the wells of water he digged. But there was no violence. But, you know, most of this is based on Isaac's relinquishing of his claim to those wells. You know, whether or not Abimelech had anything to do with that is, you know, not specifically said. But Isaac then, in verse 30, he makes them a feast, and they eat and drink, and depart in peace. But, you know, and I haven't read those verses yet, but the point is Isaac is eager to be at peace with these people. And it's probably well, because even though he is mighty, and they say he is greater than they, and they obviously have a great deal of respect and fear for him. If at any time he were to fall on hard times, he wouldn't want them to be falling upon him and destroying him. So he is the same towards them, and he's willing to enter into this covenant of peace with them that he won't do any, even though they've been kind of unkind to him, they have not harmed him. So he's willing to enter into this agreement whether, you know, he's not going to use his advantage against them. That's what they're anxious about, because they see him rising as a like a rising power of, in his prosperity, and says, this man is the blessed of the Lord. I mean, they know the God he worships. It's not their God, but that you are the blessed of your God. And so we see this, and we do not want to fall afoul of that. And they realize that they have been somewhat, you know, that there's a need for this covenant, because it's not been all roses and happiness between the Philistines and Isaac. So they seek to make this covenant. You know, and Isaac feels they hate him. You know, you've sent me away from you. And then he says in verse 30, or not he says, but it says, and he made them a feast, and they did eat and drink. And they rose up betimes in the morning and swore one to another. And Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him concerning the well which they had digged, and said unto him, We have found water. And I believe this is the well from back in verse 25, where he builded the altar, and they were digging a well. And it didn't say they'd found the water yet, but Abimelech has come to him, and they have this feast. And God says, you know, fear not, I am with you, and will bless you. And so this comes, and he makes peace with the Philistines. And at the same time, he finds the water. Verse 33, and he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. And Sheba means an oath, the well of the oath. 34. And Esau is 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah did not care for Esau's wives. He took two wives, and Isaac and Rebekah were grieved with this choice. They were Hittites, people of a vastly different custom. You'll remember back, there was already a time when the Hittites had offered, or some Hittites, I should say, they wanted to give Abraham the place to bury his wife, or there was a Hittite, as I recall. It's a little fuzzy. But the Hittite wanted to sell him, or wanted to give him the land, but Abraham insisted on buying it. And now, it's not so much an ethnic difference. I mean, like, don't think about it. We would think in terms of ethnicity. But I want you to think in terms of culture. You should not marry outside of the family of God. You know, the family of God. And for Abraham and his descendants, they got to go back to where they came from to find the appropriate wife of near enough kin where it's of the same family, so to speak. And not near family, but of general family. And that came to be sort of thought of in terms of ethnicity. But certainly in, the idea being that if you take wives of a different culture, that's what your children are going to be raised as. And they're not going to be what they need, what they're supposed to be. If you take a wife who's practices voodoo, you know, or your children are going to be influenced by voodoo, and perhaps, you know, completely raised in that. And so, you know, we also as Christians always should marry within the family of Christ. It is not wise to marry an unbeliever. It is not wise to marry someone outside of that cultural bound. You don't want to marry someone of a different culture than you. And for a Christian, that is the culture of Christians. You know, while ethnicity can be an issue sometimes, and certainly depending on the country and stuff, it can be an issue, but it's no issue in terms of God in Christ. There's no reason in Christianity I can think of to forbid the marrying of people of different races if they're both sincere Christians. Socially, there can be issues with that and problems, whatever, but it's not something I really, you know, care to comment much on, because it's really, I think, if the union is of God, then it's of God. And like, we are not primarily citizens of any country or part of any ethnic group. If we identify first with some ethnic group, if that's our primary identification and our Christianity doesn't trump all that, I would not say that it, you know, that you're required, whatever, but it's like, you know, I'm just saying that forbidding people on that basis, if you are attracted to people who look like you, there's nothing to be ashamed of in that. If you are one ethnicity and you want to marry someone of a similar ethnicity, you don't have to be ashamed. You don't have to, you know, you have to prove anything to anybody. Whatever, people are different and everybody has different tastes. And so it's not, you know, the primary thing is that we marry someone that we can live with our entire lives and be faithful to. So, you know, that is important. You know, you want to choose correctly. And certainly in the faith is the most important consideration. Anyways, so this choice of Esau is outside of the faith, outside of, or at least of their ancestral culture. So that clash is causing grief, as it will. So we will see further how this goes when we continue in the book of Genesis. And that concludes our study. Thank you for joining me. You can find all my studies on oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org. Thank you for joining me in this study. I look forward to studying with you again very soon.